Okay. Quick recap of everything we've done so far. See? Jewish Christians. See, not bad. Oh, yeah, I didn't tell you that bit. That bit I forgot. The same word is used in Greek, which was the language of most early Christians, for Passover and the Christian Easter. So you see that Christians call their celebration Pascha, just as Greek Jews would call it Pascha. It's the same word. And if any of you know other European languages, that's the word for Easter in most other European languages. There we are. What? 1 Corinthians 5:7. What? There we are. It's good going. There we are. This is Pastor Dave. Good job. I'm really Chris. Yep. Changing. It's all true. I wasn't making it up. So there we are. The core elements of the Easter liturgy are the vigil of readings and the Eucharist. And to that, as I say, we need to add the development of baptism at Easter. At first, not universally. It was restricted to North Africa and Rome, as far as we're aware, and probably developed for practical reasons. People were expected to fast before baptism. Not just the people who were being baptized, not even the clergy who were doing the baptism, but the congregation was supposed to fast before baptism. And people have been fasting before Easter, so it seems like a good time to celebrate baptism, because you don't have to fast twice. Not only you don't have to come to church twice, you don't have to fast twice. And then, of course, that it was St. Paul's theology of baptism, which had largely been neglected in the church up to that point, about in Romans 6, about how when we're baptized, we die with Christ and are raised with Christ, comes to make a lot of sense. Because it's happening at the time of the dying and rising of Christ. So a theology of baptism based on St. Paul's teaching comes to the fore in the church. The occasion and the theology fit together. And so it becomes, in the 4th century, the normative time for baptism in all churches. After the conversion of Constantine, churches tend to be more alike, and they all adopt this model of including baptism within the Easter celebration. And the final element is what we call the service of light, the lighting of the Easter candle. And again, this develops slowly, and it develops out of something that happened every evening in early Christian homes, or was supposed to happen every evening in early Christian homes. Nobody went around checking on it. And that is to give thanks at the end of the day, for the light of the day, as you lit the lamps to see in the dark. In cultures before they had electric light, the lighting of the lamps in the evening was a very key moment. As it got too dark to anything else, there was a little domestic ceremony, not only in Christian homes, but in others too, of lighting the lamps for the evening and offering a prayer as you did so. And so this became part of the daily ritual of many Christians. It became part of the services of the Christian church every evening. Evensong has its roots in the lighting of the evening lamp as it goes dark. Obviously they did that on Saturday evening before Easter like they did on any other night. But because it's the Saturday evening before Easter, the light gains even greater symbolism. It's thought of as the light of Christ, which illuminates the darkness of this world, and the light of the resurrection that we're about to celebrate. And so that part of the service gets longer and more complex than the rest. We'll take a look at that in a moment, but I'm going to pause there because you've had me pouring out all my thoughts to you. There may be questions in your mind. I don't want to save those to the end and then say, oh, sorry, we don't have time to answer that. So I'm going to pause now in case you'd like to comment or question.
I have a question.
Yep.
Is this all still in the month of Nisan?
As far as Jews are concerned, yes. But, of course, the Christians aren't doing their calendar anymore by the Jewish calendar.
Okay.
So it's happening at the same time of year, and that's why often you'll find that Passover and Easter are very close together in modern times, because we're all using the same astronomical knowledge. But of course Christians are not using the Jewish names for the months anymore. So that's why it can be any time from late March to late April.
How about baptism? Was it by immersion?
Yes. Immersion. Okay. Total immersion.
We did that in Houston.
Yeah. Although, actually, it would be more correct to say total immersion rather than total submersion. Baptists tend to do it by submersion. You know, people go right under the water. And in all the epic pictures of the life of Jesus, they think Jesus did the same. But early Christians with house churches tended not to have swimming pools or anything of a size to do that in. So it would happen in what had been the bathroom, and people would have water poured all over them while they stood in it. As one of my students said, "Oh, you mean the shower rather than the tub?" They both, you get immersed in both, they're just different methods of doing it. Of course, this would still, because they were unclothed, this would happen in a separate baptistry once we get churches. It didn't happen in the front of the church so everyone could see. That's a very modern idea that we need to see everything. Oh yes, it sounds as though we need a course on the history of baptism, doesn't it? Nobody knows for sure when children's baptism started. There are plenty of people who tell you they do, but nobody knows for sure. It's a matter of probabilities. But they were certainly doing it in some places, North Africa for sure, again by the beginning of the 3rd century, children were involved. Whether it goes back to New Testament, we can spend an hour discussing that, but perhaps not in this course. Okay, if you've got your books, we can take the remainder of the time available to us. What have we got, about 15 minutes? Just beginning to look at Easter, and then finish the Vigil of Easter, and then finish off, and then we'll go back and look at things next week at Good Friday and Maundy Thursday and so on. And if you've been waiting eagerly for Palm Sunday, you'll have to come back right at the very end of the course. The service of light, then, the lighting of the Paschal candle, was simply, to begin with, just a matter of striking a light and lighting the candle as they did every evening. It was as simple as that and saying a prayer over it. But, of course, it gets very elaborated and now, in a sense, has much more of an elaborate setting to it and seems to make it more important in the service than anything else, which I think is a pity because, although it is obviously important, it maybe overshadows, just because of the drama of it, the other elements which, from a spiritual point of view, are just as important, or perhaps even more important. Service begins on page 285 with some preparatory prayers. Notice, indeed, in the first address there, that the celebrant says, "This is the Passover of the Lord." So the elements of Passover theology that we were talking about still remain, even in this new setting. And again, it talks about it as the Paschal feast in the next prayer. I think one of the reasons that people give it such importance is it is really probably the most dramatic moment. There you are in a darkened church, and there, right at the back, are the three witches from Macbeth doing things over there. Saying spells and incantations and so on. This is because it has attracted to itself something that, again, began in pagan Ireland and only gradually came into the Catholic tradition and then was adopted here, of making a lot of the new fire. It is a purely Irish custom that, because people liked it, it took off in the rest of the church. And so we have these elements around striking the flint of a new fire, or as in many cases nowadays, cigarette lighters. It's still a flint. And marking the cross with the sign of the cross and the year, the Alpha and Omega, Christ the beginning and the end, and marking the five wounds of Christ by putting grains of incense in. So you can see how the vision of the Paschal candle as the light of Christ has given grounds for developing its Christic nature, if you like, but by these various additions to it. Do stop me if you've got questions, because I don't want us to run out of time and you have to go home and think, oh, I've got to wait till next week to ask a question, I won't remember. So that forms the beginning. Our prayer book doesn't make a great deal of it, but most parishes do. Because once you've got it, you're not going to let go of something as fancy as that. Even if no one except the clergy huddled around it can see it until it's paraded through the church.
It helps on the record.
And so as you'll see at the foot of that page, in order to get the candle into the church and on its candlestick, there's this procession through the darkness with the candle lit and so on. The idea of distributing candles to the congregation, again, is a later development. The Paschal candle was the big thing. And because in most places it burned traditionally all the way through Eastertide, many of them, particularly in cathedrals, were huge. Just massive, because they had to last all through the Easter season without ever being put out. If you thought that our candle says it all through the Easter season, 24 hours a day, and you thought it was God's miracle that it keeps going, I hate to disappoint you, but it's put out after the service. I remember when I was a parish priest, someone would come rushing up to me and say, Father, the candle's been put out! In great shock and horror, because they thought it really did last all the way through. So representing Christ's light, and then the notion of the light of Christ gradually spreading throughout the world is very powerfully symbolised by it. I mean, although I've sort of criticised a bit overdoing it, I have to say, for me, one of the most emotional parts of the service is always that moment in the darkened church when the candles are spreading. And you can imagine, in the years when I was assisting at Westminster Abbey, watching them spread throughout a huge abbey church. It was unforgettable, and I think symbolically it does, as so often in the church, it's the actions we do that actually affect us spiritually and form us spiritually. That's the gradual passing of the light and so on, as against the texts of the prayers, which we're lucky if we remember much about afterwards. But then we have this on pages 286 and 287, this enormously long prayer called the Exultet, which is simply the first word of the prayer in its original Latin. Again, this developed 8th, 9th century period out of the simple evening prayer at the lighting of the light, because it's Easter, becomes an enormously long prayer in which the story of our salvation is rehearsed. So there's a hymn on the first page, and then it begins as though it's the Eucharistic prayer, the Lord be with you, let us give thanks to the Lord our God, at the foot of the prayer. And then it continues very much like a Eucharistic prayer in its style and tone and language, giving thanks for Christ, who is the true Paschal Lamb, who at the feast, I'm on the first paragraph of page 287, who at the feast of the Passover paid for us the debt of Adam's sin, and by his blood delivered your faithful people. So it's picking up on the Exodus themes of the Passover, of smearing the doorposts with the blood of the Paschal Lamb, and so on, in picking up the notion of Christ as our true Paschal Lamb. This is the night when you brought our fathers out of bondage in Egypt. This is the night when all who believed in Christ are delivered from the gloom of sin and restored to grace and holiness, an allusion to baptism there. This is the night when Christ broke the bonds of death and hell and wrote victorious. The next bit have lines against them because people who want it shorter can miss them out and so on. And then if you go to the last paragraph of the prayer, Holy Father, accept our evening sacrifice, the offering of this candle in your honour. harks back to that very domestic ceremony of the evening lighting of the candle. So even in places where they celebrate the Eucharist after midnight, the language still is of the evening light, because that's the roots of the prayer. Yeah? Okay. And then we move on into... and of course, that's why it comes at the beginning, because it was the beginning of evening prayer, which then led into, on Holy Saturday, into the vigil. And so there's a strange, at least it always feels to me, and maybe not to you, but it always feels strange to me that this enormous celebration of the light of Christ triumphing, and it's as though we've reached the high point of the evening, and then we all sit down and start this vigil and only get back to ringing our bells and doing whatever we're going to do much later on. It's a historical accident in a way. It's because it comes out of this beginning of the evening. When I had a chance to influence the Church of England in changing its practices, I tried to persuade them to move it up so it became the beginning of the Eucharist, and so we sat through the darkness of the vigil, watching and waiting, and then only after that did light come. I was fought by the people who, in the Anglican Church, who believe that only if it's what Rome is doing can it be right. And so we had to end up compromising. So unlike your book, we have both versions in our English book, and people pick and choose as they wish. In fact, if you've ever been to an Eastern Orthodox celebration of Easter, you'll find that that's pretty well how it is, that there's an extremely long vigil beforehand, before you get to the candle bit, because they weren't constrained by the same things.
I'm thinking about the practicality.
Not very well is the answer. You have to have low lights. I mean, I agree. Candles help you see in the darkness, and so if you light the candles, it's worth. But I don't know. We do manage. I just can't remember now. I've been here too long. We do. We have to have low lighting. So keep that. Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Three times.
Yeah, Christians always do things in threes. People produce reasons for it. I just think Christians always do things in threes. No, really. I mean, seriously. The tradition in the early churches is you sang three psalms. You know, you said three prayers. Kyrie eleison, Lord have mercy, we sing three times, and so on. It's a sacred number, but nobody knows why or when we started doing it, because it's lost really back in early Christianity, but it's so deeply ingrained in us that we do things three times. When they used to have more than one collect at the beginning of the Eucharist, they always had, if you didn't have two, you always had to have three, and so on. But of course, again, it adds to the drama of the thing, because there is this sense of movement. I mean, that's one of the, I think, the powerful things about the Easter liturgy, is it has a sense of movement throughout, both physical movement, but also a sense that we're going somewhere. We're on a pilgrimage. We're on a journey from darkness to light, and so on. And so the stopping three times. I mean, it has the practical purpose of enabling you to light the candles of the congregation as you pass, but that's not really why it's there. It is just part of that. And this, the verse being sung on a rising note, again, gives that build-up to the climax. And so we come to the Liturgy of the Word at a few minutes before 11. So I think I'm going to hold that over. Look, so just to, if we can pass over those pages for now, we'll have a look at what the readings are next time. But you'll see, if you go to page 292, that the idea is that baptism will take place then at that point, so the newly baptized can share in the Easter Eucharist that follows. It's a modern idea of having the renewal of baptismal vows at this point. But I think a very good one, because again, it involves the whole congregation in the action. For very many years, baptisms stopped happening at Easter. Partly because after the early centuries, the difficulties of getting candidates for baptism at Easter. Once we moved to having children baptized, and there weren't many adults left to convert, it wouldn't take many generations before there were only babies and children. Once we had that, in a world where infant mortality was very high, the idea of saying, bring your child for baptism next Easter, the child might not be around. And so increasingly baptisms took place near a birth. And so the notion of Easter as the normative season for baptism, which was the theory, and the theory was kept, in practice, many places couldn't get candidates for baptism at Easter. And so the idea of blessing the font and then adding to that, which is all that was left, they blessed the font, they blessed the water, and no candidates, but it still stayed in the Easter liturgy. Then the idea of adding a renewal of baptismal vows for the congregation was a help to get over the shortage of baptismal candidates, because it gave that baptismal element to the service and enabled us to see its link to dying and rising with Christ by sharing in that, which I think it inspired, though much more modern development. That's why we've got that, and then it continues into the Eucharistic liturgy proper, where again it's, as it were, the second climax of the service. I hope that's been helpful to you. As I say, we'll start next time, if you can bear to come back again, by looking at the readings before we move on to look at some other parts of Holy Week.
Thank you. Thank you.